Long ago, when I was a young freelance journalist traveling in remote parts of Africa, I quickly grew to appreciate the luxury of pulling out my battery-run shortwave radio and hearing this sound.
This is London.
Suddenly, even if I was in a tent, swatting flies in sweltering heat, I was connected with the world. And I wasn't alone, then or now, in appreciating what shortwave radio can do.
I was a teacher in Zimbabwe in the early 1980s, shortly after Robert Mugabe became first prime minister and then president of that country. He's still there, by the way.
This is David Smith, a friend and former editor of mine. More on that in a moment.
I taught at a Bush school. There was no TV. There was very little access to outside information. And I remember as a geography teacher, one of the first questions one of my students asked me, and these are people who had never been to the closest town. They'd probably never been in a motor vehicle at the time. I think the first question in my geography class is, what is the Taliban doing in Afghanistan? And I'm sure I did not give an appropriate answer. It's quite possible my student knew more than I did about what the Taliban was doing in Afghanistan at the time.
Because they listened to shortwave radio, the only kind they could get, and that many places in Africa even today can get, because they don't have electricity to send out an FM signal. I'd started out in journalism thinking I'd be a newspaper reporter. But over time, I felt a magnetic pull to radio, and it was thanks in part to those evenings holding a crackly shortwave radio to my ear. Stories told with sound just came to life in a different way. My friend David followed this path too. He learned radio reporting and production at a station in South Africa, then ended up working back in Canada, his home country, at Radio Canada International. I was based in Bangkok back then. He called me and asked me to start contributing. I did, and that was the start of about 5 years of working together as editor and freelance foreign correspondent, usually talking several times a week. The second part of that time, he was at Radio Netherlands. And then he launched into an interestingly different chapter. He went back to South Africa, which was then still under apartheid, and helped transform Capital Radio from a station that blared beach music for white guys into one that served the majority black population in Transkei. Then he started doing post-conflict radio projects with the United Nations, in the former Yugoslavia, in the Central African Republic, in the Congo, where he founded the still popular Radio Okapi, in Somalia, and now in Nigeria and other countries in the Lake Chad region, where the Islamist insurgents Boko Haram are still active. In each place, David says, radio has been able to inform, change minds, and help people imagine a different kind of future for themselves.
Radio is king on this continent. To reach the people of the Lake Chad area, using anything other than radio will be a failure. There's an incredibly high illiteracy rate. There's no developed infrastructure, so, you know, even if you could deliver newspapers, people couldn't read them, they couldn't afford to buy them, people don't have TV sets.
And all of this brings up an interesting question. In this century of high-tech media and weaponry and targeted strikes, are we overlooking the enduring effectiveness in countering terrorism and doing so much more of this old, fading technology, shortwave radio? This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstad. And this is Dandal Kura Radio International. Dandal Kura means meeting place in the language Kanuri, which is spoken by about 10 million people in the area where Boko Haram roams, northeastern Nigeria, Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. But funny thing, until Dandal Kura, there had not been a Kanuri language radio network that reached across borders the way Boko Haram does. In fact, there hadn't been a Kanuri language radio station. Of course, Boko Haram members aren't big fans of radio programs that give people ideas anyway, certainly not ideas different from the ones that Boko Haram wants them to hold. So, during the years when Boko Haram controlled most of northeast Nigeria's Borno state, there wasn't a lot of room for radio. But then, a couple of years ago, a new Nigerian president came in, military efforts were beefed up, Boko Haram was driven back, though they certainly haven't given up, and some of the 2 million people displaced by Boko Haram violence are starting to go back to their homes and farms and to the half-million-person city of Maiduguri, which was once a Boko Haram stronghold and where Dandelkura now has a station. Its manager, who works closely with my friend David, who we're going to get back to soon, is Farouk Dalhatu. We spoke via Skype.
We use our platform to provide information, every kind of information, from health issues, what to do, where to go, how to do things, and if you see something, say something, stuff like that.
Farouk used to be a businessman in trade. He got into radio about 14 years ago, he says, because of the need for independent voices in the region's media and because he realized what radio could provide.
In crisis situation, information is very, very important. Sometimes more than food, one needs information because you want to know if you are on the run, you want to know whether the direction you are headed is safe before you even think of close family members that had been separated from you.
These days, the crisis is no longer that acute for most of the people reached by Dandelkura. Indeed, among the many things it does, it's helping families reunite, including families of some of those 270 schoolgirls that Boko Haram kidnapped in 2014. A third of them were released in May 2017 in a prisoner exchange.
Well, the tide is turned, because now people can travel from one village to another with minimal risk. Of course, still, don't get me wrong, still there are places where people need military escorts to cross some parts of the Sambisa forest, which is the main forest that are resided now.
And the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has warned that Boko Haram appears to be rearming and regrouping in that forest. The threat is much lower than it was when they were rampaging across the region, but they have killed more than 200 people over the past year. While it's safer than it was, farmers are still wary about going out and planting crops and living on their farms where they'll be isolated and open to attack. And that's a problem in a region that's known as Africa's breadbasket. Some 5 million people now face acute food shortages, and almost 50,000 face famine. Even for those with enough food, there's the issue of how to get back to normal life, how to work through the trauma caused by 8 years of violence. Say your daughter or wife was abducted by Boko Haram, and she came back with a baby. Say your son joined Boko Haram, and then decided he wanted to rejoin his community and his family. Sometimes people need a little help to work through their complicated feelings about all this. So Dandelkura has guests who talk about these things, who effectively serve as counselors.
Sometimes the counseling is religious, because people need to be reassured that they were not doing something spiritually wrong. So we employ the clergy, both Christian and Muslim clergy, to come and give their opinions. And sometimes the counseling is psychological or social. Then we get academicians from the university, experts, to come and see if they can penetrate into the minds of community and give them some comfort that it is okay. It's not the fault of these people. They are victims themselves, and they must be seen as victims. Sometimes the counseling needs the intervention of the traditional rulers, who will now come and say, no, it's okay. These are our brothers and sisters and wives. We need to accept them if they repudiate their ways. So the radio here comes in very handy.
It comes in handy for a lot of things. Dandelkura also has a program called You and the Law, which informs citizens of their rights and what they can do if officials abuse those rights. And that's important because disgust with a culture of impunity was part of what helped Boko Haram gain ground in the first place. This growing radio network in Western Africa, the first to connect Kanuri speakers, which incidentally is also the language of Boko Haram, is serving as a powerful counterweight to the messages of fear Boko Haram has been spreading. And it could be a possible model for use in places where ISIS and the Taliban and other extremist groups operate around the world. And the idea of doing all this in Boko Haram territory this way came from my old friend and editor David Smith, who's been spending much of his time these days in areas where Boko Haram has long roamed, helping to strengthen and expand this radio network. During one of his breaks back home in Johannesburg, when I was there, we sat down in his backyard to talk about the rather remarkable post-conflict radio endeavors he's helped create since he was my editor. A listening note, South Africa has lots of birds, some of them loud. You'll hear them as we go. We started by talking about how David got into creating this radio network, Dandalkura, in areas where Boko Haram is active.
I went off to Nigeria, to Kano, to see what project was being put together, and there was a plan to develop a one-hour recorded program in Hausa, the main language of northern Nigeria, and broadcast it on local radio stations. I thought this wasn't a good idea. I thought it could be something much more interesting. First of all, after doing a bit of research, it seems that the most useful language for such programming would be Kanuri, the main language around the Lake Chad area, and the main language used by Boko Haram. I also didn't think a one-hour recorded program going on to local radio stations was a good idea because, well, first, 1 hour isn't very long. Recorded is not interactive. It doesn't involve discussion with the local community. And the local radio stations generally weren't very good and didn't have much of a reach in the lake area. So came up with another plan that eventually turned into a plan for a still-developing regional network. When this project began, the president of Nigeria was Goodluck Jonathan. And Goodluck Jonathan had a number of weaknesses governing Nigeria. The fight against Boko Haram was not a fight that his government was winning. Boko Haram controlled a lot of territory in the northeast, and the Nigerian army, with undoubtedly good intentions, didn't have the means to fight Boko Haram. So Boko Haram was making gains. After Goodluck Jonathan lost elections in 2015, the end of 2015, and Buhari, his successor, was inaugurated in 2016, the situation changed. The Nigerian army received better support, logistical support, material support, and was able to drive Boko Haram out of a lot of the traditional areas it had been holding. That's the good news. The bad news is a lot of the fighting shifted to neighboring countries, notably northern Cameroon, southeastern Niger, and the Chadian side of the lake, which made it more important than ever for the radio project we were developing to include those areas. It's fine to offer a platform for people in Nigeria, northeastern Nigeria, to speak and discuss the problems they're encountering and look for ways to combat Boko Haram, to combat the insurgency, but it's not really fine if their neighbors, their cousins, their kith and kin in the neighboring countries aren't included as well. And today, as I sit with you in the garden, just back from Chad, I'm very pleased to say that an N'Djamena studio for Dandalkura Radio International is under construction. The Maiduguri studios in northeastern Borno State in Nigeria have been on the air since April of 2016. And it looks as if funding for studios in Diffa in southeastern Niger, Mora in northern Cameroon, and Bagassola on the north shore of Lake Chad in Chad is imminent. So we're creating the world's first Kanuri language radio network. In fact, when Maiduguri opened in April of 2016, it became the first Kanuri language radio station in the world. That doesn't mean there aren't other radio stations that have Kanuri programming, but the Kanuri language is just a minority language on the few radio stations on the planet that broadcast in Kanuri.
Tell me about the journalists you work with in Maiduguri. And actually, I mean, have they been directly affected by Boko Haram, they and their families?
I think it's safe to say there's nobody in the Northeast who hasn't been affected by Boko Haram. Maiduguri, when Dandalkura Radio went on the air, the security situation in Maiduguri was extremely difficult. It wasn't the right time to move a radio team to Maiduguri where they could operate with any kind of sense of security. So we started off in Kano. By the time early 2016 had rolled up, the security situation in Maiduguri had improved dramatically. A lot of that had to do with the new Nigerian president, Buhari, properly funding and arming the Nigerian armed forces to help deal with the Boko Haram threat. So most of the people who were working in Kano actually came from Borno State. Borno State is the far northeastern state of Nigeria that borders Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. And the people that we initially hired to work at Dandalkura Radio in Kano had almost exclusively come from Borno State. They were IDPs, internally displaced persons, fleeing, for the most part, Borno State with their families for safety reasons, to stay alive. All of them, without exception, wanted to return to Maiduguri when the situation improved. And when it did improve, they moved lock, stock, and barrel back to Maiduguri. Finding people who are devoted to this project is quite easy because there's this enormous pride in being able to speak in the Kanuri mother tongue and speak to a Kanuri audience that has never heard its mother tongue on the air before.
What do you put on the air? What kind of programming do you put on the air?
News bulletins, news and current affairs, that's the bread and butter of programming. I mean, we have a network of stringers throughout the Northeast. The main states that are affected by the insurgency, Borno State, Adamawa State, and Yobe State, there are stringers in all the main centers there. We have stringers in southeastern Niger, in Diffa, and Zinder, stringers in northern Cameroon, and stringers in Chad. So that every day, using appropriate technology, you know, in this case it's mainly cell phones, WhatsApp, and other social media, SMSs, simple things like that, send their reports in to the newsroom in Maiduguri, where the news editor and team edit and put packages together to go on the air every day for what is currently a six-hour broadcast day.
When I first heard you talk about this, or when you first wrote about it to me in an email, I was thinking, oh, so this is kind of like a non-governmental Voice of America for Boko Haram areas, where you're presenting a different way of life and perhaps even information about Boko Haram and why you shouldn't be taking them seriously or something. But it sounds like it's not really that. It's kind of more like a BBC.
I'd like to see this develop into a long-term radio service, possibly even a commercial radio service, that serves the roughly 10 million Kanuris who live in the four countries around Lake Chad and beyond. You're a radio person. Imagine having a radio market, a potential market of 10 million people that has no competition. It's the only Kanuri language radio station. In northern Nigeria, in Niger, in Cameroon, in Chad, the most listened to radio stations by far are international radio stations that are not based on the African continent. In northern Nigeria, the most listened to radio service by far is the Hausa language service of the BBC. Following the BBC in listenership numbers are radio stations like Deutsche Welle and its Hausa service, The Voice of America and its Hausa service. In the Francophone countries, Radio France International and its French and Hausa and Arabic services are also incredibly popular. There are a number of reasons why people are listening to these shortwave services. One, because they can pick them up. There is no FM network there. So if you want to listen to the radio in a lot of the areas around Lake Chad and much of the continent, much of the Sahel is that band of territory that runs between the Sahara Desert and the more lush agricultural regions to the south, extending from Senegal and the Atlantic Ocean in the west all the way to the Arabian Peninsula in the east. That area is where there's very little infrastructure and people are listening to shortwave in a big way. They're also listening to it because, you know, frankly, most people don't trust the national state broadcasters of their home country, whether it be in Nigeria, Chad, Cameroon, or Niger, because they're generally believed to be his master's voice, the voice of whatever ruling party is in power. And even if some state broadcasters do manage to put together some good programming, and obviously they do, no matter how good it is, there's always the shadow of propaganda hanging over them, that people don't believe what's being said. What helps for Dandalkura broadcasting in Kanuri Most Kanuri-speaking people, with the exception of Chad, speak Hausa as a second language. So it's sort of a lingua franca in the wider Lake Chad area. So Kanuri-speaking people have an existing tradition of listening to shortwave and Hausa right now. And they're listening, for the most part, on very inexpensive, poor quality, made-in-China radios, usually of a brand called Kachibo. Everybody's got a little Kachibo radio that they can find in the most remote market in the Sahel. And they're not digital, they're analog. You know, you can't punch in the frequency you want. You have to know where it is. You know, a 15-year-old sheep herder 200 kilometers north of Bagassola on the north shore of Lake Chad knows at what time and where that you can find the BBC Hausa service or VOA or Deutsche Welle as they turn that little dial on that little radio with lousy sound, but they listen because they want information. Dandal Kura broadcasts on shortwave on a frequency that, dare I say, is very close to the BBC Hausa service. Because they're using analog radios, when they're turning the dial to look for BBC, they stumble across Dandal Kura, hear Kanuri, and stay there. People have asked, you know, what kind of a marketing budget do you have to tell people about this radio station and make sure you create a listenership? We don't have a marketing budget. We don't need one. I hope the funders didn't hear that. We don't need one, but we need a little one. But basically, word of mouth spreads very quickly. An evaluation of the radio service in northeastern Borno State was carried out at the request of one of the main funders by an independent evaluation service based in the UK. The results of that survey were more than positive. Brand recognition of Dandal Kura Radio in Borno State is well over 90%. And most people who listen to it, when I say most people, over 90% say they like it, they believe it, they trust it. Perhaps even more importantly, this evaluation house found that people who listen to Dandal Kura tend to be less likely to believe that violence is a means to an end in northeastern Nigeria than those who don't listen to Dandal Kura. Those who don't listen to Dandal Kura, to some extent, think that violence will achieve the goals of stability in the region.
And why would Dandal Kura have made that kind of impact? I mean, what messages do you have in the programming that you send out that would make people change their minds about the role of violence?
Alternatives to violence. You know, I think most people in the region know, understand, believe that militarily Boko Haram will be defeated. What will not perhaps have been addressed adequately is what to do about the conditions that allowed Boko Haram to exist in the first place. Peace and stability are probably relatively easy to achieve. Until people have jobs, until people believe that they have some kind of link with influencing elected officials, until people believe that security forces are there to protect them rather than to, at best, harass them, at worst, threaten their lives, until they have access to education, until they have access to adequate health care, the conditions that allowed an extremist group to exist will remain, and Boko Haram will come back in another form, as it has in many other countries on the continent and elsewhere on the planet. So part of the raison d'etre for Dandal Kura is to allow experts and simple farmers and students and goat herders to have a place to talk about what bothers them and how they see, I mean, I don't want to sound like a greeting card, but how they see a brighter future. What does it take to make things better? We started doing town hall meetings where listeners in the field in rural areas can interact with politicians, with academics. There have been town hall meetings with the University of Maiduguri, with politicians from Borno State. We're about to start programs with the Multinational Joint Task Force. That's an African Union mandated peace operation headquartered in Chad with soldiers from Chad, Niger, Cameroon, Nigeria, and Benin that are operating throughout the Lake Chad area to try to bring stability. Stability is a good thing, but it's not the end of the story. You know, there'll have to be a military presence to keep that stability until there's something put in place to offer an alternative lifestyle that gives people hope. So Dandal Kura, when it went on the air, I mean, one of its main goals, and it's a goal it's achieving, I'm pleased to say, is to offer a pan-Lake Chad region dialogue for all Kanuris so that a community is created. There's solidarity. People who suffer an attack in Diffa in southeastern Niger know they're not alone when they hear of the problems people in Mora in northern Cameroon are having.
Daji barisa ganala, nji yam ganala, tosunuma barisa.
Ade.
Daji kwade, I
mentioned a little bit earlier about working with the multinational joint task force. You know, Daniel Kura is building a studio at the headquarters of the MNJTF in N'Djamena so that the task force has the ability to communicate directly with the local population, and the local population has the ability to communicate directly with the forces that are mandated to protect them. Now, why is this vitally important? In January of 2017, there was a horrible accident, and I don't even know what other word to use, but there was a horrible event that took place in northern Nigeria where the Nigerian Air Force bombed twice an IDP camp, killing a couple of hundred people. The estimates are roughly around 265 people. This is the kind of thing that when it happens, people are terrified, and it can be a good method of recruitment for insurgent organizations like Boko Haram. You know, the military forces of any of the countries involved don't always have the most diplomatic means of stabilizing the communities they enter. These are, you know, they're good people who are scared. They go out there like anybody else into an area where you can't necessarily recognize who the bad guys are. Young girls as young as 7 years old are strapped with explosives going into crowded areas and being detonated by remote control. So it's terrifying work. And, you know, there's just because you're a soldier with a gun doesn't mean you're not worried about these things.
What about for you going into those areas?
Oh, I believe very strongly in the work I do. Do I have a death wish? Of course not. I mean, no, I've been doing it for a long time. I have a young family, and the young family that I have has made me think more about what I do over the last few years than I have done during the roughly 30 years I've been doing radio in difficult places. I guess I've been lucky. My time hasn't come. I go to sleep at night believing I've done something good. I just try not to think about it. I'm inspired by the wonderful people I work with who are great people who know they're doing something to build their country. The stringers are in more danger than I am. The journalists who go out there are in more danger than I am. And they know that. They know that their country, their region has been ignored, has been suffering, not for years, not for the roughly 7 years that Boko Haram has been very active, but for decades, for even centuries. The whole Lake Chad region, the whole Sahel region has known periods of extreme violence for well over 100 years. This is just the latest wave of violence. And that violence, I fear, will continue until strong efforts to create a better quality of life for the people who live there are given a strong foundation. Infrastructure's got to be built, skills have to be made, there has to be good governance, there has to be some kind of radical shift in the way politics operates in those regions so that people can actually have some kind of trust in the people who are elected to office. I mean, Nigeria had part of the resource curse. You know, Nigeria is the biggest oil producer in Africa. And for many years, not only was there trouble in the northeast, but trouble in the Niger Delta, where the oil comes from. And no matter how much trouble there was, how much violence, how much political violence, how many armed attacks there were by rebel groups, the oil kept coming out of the ground. So it meant, to some extent, those in public office didn't really have to worry about what the local population felt about the way they were governing or not governing the country, as long as the oil kept coming out. Things have changed a little bit, partially because the oil price has dropped. Nigeria needs to find new sources of income to run the country. And there's a concerted effort by the current president to try to deal with extremely high levels of corruption in Nigeria. And when I say Nigeria, the problems are more or less mirror imaged in the neighboring countries as well. I mean, Nigeria just has the advantage of the vast oil supplies. I mean, part of the big motivation for Daniel Kura Radio and my involvement in it is that the people who are affected by the insurgency, by bad governance, by all the lack of development, are the people who are generally never consulted. Daniel Kura is where they get consulted. Daniel Kura is where they get to say, well, this is what's wrong, this is what we'd like to do, and, you know, maybe if we tried it this way. Will it work? Everything's a risk, but at least the opportunity for dialogue is there now, and that's the most important part.
So does Daniel Kura actually come out and say, something as blunt as, look, Boko Haram is bad and this is why? Or is it more that just by having this range of different sorts of information and conversation that they hope that people will be better informed?
I think it's a combination of both of those things. It's not an anti-Boko Haram radio. It's not a pro-Boko Haram radio either. But keep something very clearly in mind here. The people who are in Boko Haram are from the region, for the most part. I mean, there are always exceptions. But they come from the Lake Chad area. They're of Lake Chad. They have brothers and sisters and mothers and cousins who live in all the places around Lake Chad. We have this radio drama that runs on Dandalkura, produced by, presented and written by local Kanuris in the area. It's called Yarakaliad Kijewa, and it's extremely popular. In this radio drama, there are members of Boko Haram, and their brothers and sisters are ordinary villagers, and part of the dialogue involves the members of Boko Haram trying to recruit other people in the village to join the movement, and then there are those who are not in Boko Haram trying to convince, you know, the wayward son to come back into the fold. And they're based on real-life situations. The writers know the people concerned they're writing about. It's not a stretch for them to make up a radio fiction drama based on things that have happened to people in their own family. And horrible things happen in this radio drama. People die, people get blown up, people get killed, people get knifed. But it's real life. And why am I telling you this story? Because at the end of the day, when the foreign donors leave, when the NGOs pull out, when perhaps the multinational joint task force is disbanded, these people are still going to be living there. And they have to be dealt with. They need to be given an alternative to what they're doing as well. I mean, are some of them too far gone for that? Perhaps. But if they joined, they can be convinced to unjoin. You know, one of the things the MNJTF, the Multinational Joint Task Force, does, like many peacekeeping missions, is it has a what's known as a DDR mission, a demobilization and disarmament reintegration program to try and convince members of Boko Haram or any other insurgent group to lay down their arms and rejoin civil society. Now, it's a tough one, and any DDR program I've ever come across in UN peacekeeping missions has always had usually minimal success. But it has some success, and with perhaps more means, with more training, with more discussion on the radio, we can convince more people who belong to Boko Haram to rejoin civil society. But again, I stress, people are only going to rejoin the communities they left if the situation they're going back to offers more promise than the one they left in the first place.
You said that the journalists, the stringers who are out in the field, are taking more risks than you. Have there been any casualties with those stringers?
Not yet. Please may it never be. You know, I'm not.
That's pretty amazing, given that they're working in conflict areas.
Yeah, no, it is amazing. And even other radio, you know, at Radio Okapi, my biggest radio project to date, you know, two journalists died in the line of duty. It didn't stop their colleagues from going out and doing their job as well as they ever did for that reason, to honor their fallen colleagues. You know, again, it's not a subject one wants to dwell on. We hope it won't happen. It may. May it not.
So you've spent quite a few years working on radio in conflict areas to try to help people move to a better place, basically. And you're doing a PhD on this. Meanwhile, there's a new administration in the United States that seems focused on beefing up the military and just killing more terrorists. So when you look at that approach and the approach that you've done, what advice might you have to offer the Trump administration on effective ways to counter terrorism?
While you were asking that question, I started pulling my hair. Oh my. Dialogue is better than violence. And military action, in my books, counts as violence. Military action generally just makes people angrier and moves the threat to another place. I was in N'Djamena recently taking part in a workshop for military people on public information. I was one of the presenters. The workshop was organized by AFRICOM, the U.S. Military Command for Africa. And, you know, the United States is a big country of many different opinions, and the military is the same. And I'm very pleased to say I've worked with some wonderful people in Africa who want to do what I think is the right thing and are extremely keen on knowing how to better communicate with local populations so that they can help create a stable environment. The military is only part of the bigger picture, because then it's time for the politicians and civil society and business and everybody else to move from stability to progress.
You've seen the impact that the kind of radio projects you've worked on have had in the communities.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and one of my favorite quotes is by a former special representative of the Secretary General of the United Nations, or in simple terms, the head of the UN peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Cameroonian by the name of Amos Namanga Ngongi, said something before the Security Council in New York back in 2002 that, you know, warms my heart every time I think about it. He stood up before the Security Council and said, Radio Okapi, the UN peacekeeping mission's radio network for the DR Congo, he said, Radio Okapi has electronically destroyed the front line in the war in the Congo. Before Radio Okapi went on the air, the Congo was divided into three distinct areas that were controlled by various rebel movements, supported by armies from neighboring states as well. Now, Radio Okapi wasn't responsible on its own for removing those front lines, but it played a big part in doing so by allowing the Congolese to speak together from all parts of the country as one for the first time since a war that was sometimes termed Africa's First World War began. Rappeur, entrepreneur, sur la rumba, terre de Wemba, mettre chez nous à terre. Fils d'une mère, la rue n'élève pas le poisson, tu ne passes sur la profession, faut plus dans la tête des choses calmes. But perhaps the biggest change in radio that occurred since I got into the business is the cell phone has made radio interactive. And the Lake Chad area, with its lack of infrastructure, almost no hope for finding a job, is not unlike the rest of the world in one respect. People have cell phones. And they may not know how to read, they may not be able to type an SMS, but they can make a call to the radio station and say, we're not happy with something we've just seen, or we think it would be better if the military did this, or if our governor did that.
And to what extent in the areas where you've worked have governments been responsive to people calling into the radio and the radio broadcasting and saying, okay, people are unhappy about this?
Well, they'll either get on the radio and deny it, or they'll try to engage. When Radio Okapi first went on the air, it coincided with the opening of something called the Inter-Congolese Dialogue that was held in South Africa, involving the leaders of all the main rebel groups plus the Kabila administration, Kabila the president, in Kinshasa. So we went on the day that dialogue began, on air the day that dialogue began, the 25th of February 2002, in three of the rebel capitals, the capital Kinshasa plus the rebel capital of Kisangani and Goma. And the day that dialogue went on the air, the leader of the Rwandan-backed rebels in the far east of the Congo, in Goma, summoned me to his office where the dialogue was being held, because he said he was very unhappy with Radio Okapi. So I was a bit nervous going there. Mr. Ruberwa, who is the head of the Goma rebel administration, said to me, I have a big complaint about this new radio station you've launched. He was known for being a very difficult man, and obviously, I asked what his problem was, and he said, I don't hear my voice on the air often enough on Radio Okapi. I've heard the others, Jean-Pierre Bemba and Joseph Kabila, more often than me. So I breathed a sigh of relief, knowing that's an easy one to fix. People like to be on the radio. They like to be heard, just like they like to be on TV. You know, it's a little bit of the syndrome your current president has. They want a lot of attention. That's the same for most politicians, most people. So I called one of my journalists who worked with me, a very able journalist named Paul Madidi from Kinshasa, who happened to be there, and said, go interview Mr. Ruberwa, put him on the air, let him say whatever he wants. And then when you're finished with him, go see Jean-Pierre Bemba. When you're finished with him, go see Joseph Kabila. And that's how you get people to accept the radio. It kills the rumor mill, because as long as you let everybody talk, people can't say things that are not true without being challenged. And if they're going to be challenged and they don't have a reply for that challenge, they start veering towards the truth. Not all the time, of course, but it moves politicians when they're faced with dealing with their opponents on the air, live, on a regular basis. It moves them towards getting to the point, telling the truth. And they want to do that. It builds respect. When people speak on a trusted, credible radio service, they tend to be believed as well. And if your journalists are well trained to steer the politicians or whoever is the guest behind the microphone towards the truth through skillful questions, through challenges, then that radio service's credibility rises, and you know it's turned Radio Okapi into what I'm very pleased to say is the radio of reference for the Congo. The goal for Radio Dandalkura is to be the radio of reference for the Lake Chad region.
Have you ever dealt with any kind of political leader who tried to discredit the media organization?
Yeah, of course. The sun doesn't always shine. There are days when journalists are threatened, the radio is threatened. Very recently in the DRC, the Congolese president had the signal of Radio Okapi in Kinshasa scrambled because, you know, there were anti-government protests in the city.
But that's suggesting that those leaders know that people take that media organization seriously, as opposed to the strategy that Donald Trump is now pursuing, which is to say the media are so dishonest, don't listen or believe anything they say.
Well, I think the U.S. environment for information is very different from, that's an understatement, very different from what's happening in places like Lake Chad or the DRC. There's a serious thirst for information about the local community, about the region, and about the world in most places on this continent. Just because one doesn't have much in the way of income or in the way of material possessions doesn't mean the thirst for knowledge isn't there. In fact, perhaps that thirst is even greater. And anybody who's traveled this continent extensively cannot help but notice in isolated areas people who are obviously not people of strong financial means carrying small transistor radios next to their ear, walking down a road or a path, listening to programming. And it's usually not music. Music is there, but they're usually listening to information programs because they want to know. They don't have satellite TV or cable TV, or they're not watching reality shows. They're trying to find out what's going on in the world beyond them.
It's kind of humbling, huh? Here we are in the developed world with high-speed internet, satellite television, a fire hose of information. And yet, too many Americans seem to have lost an interest in finding out what's really going on, or an ability to be able to separate the fake news and propaganda from the really excellent journalism that's being done these days. It turns out that it takes effort to make a peaceful democracy endure, just as it takes effort to make a strife-ridden region heal. In both cases, good information matters. In Africa, lives depend on it, and an old technology from the last century is helping those lives have a better shot in this one. My thanks to my old friend David Smith and to Farouk Dahatu for talking with me about their work at Dandalkura Radio. You can find out more about it and listen to Dandalkura Live at dandalkura.com. That's dandalkura.com. The print version of this story, with photos and other links, is at pri.org/century, where you'll also find all our previous episodes. Those episodes are also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and most other podcast sites. If you've not yet subscribed, please do. I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word, or you can send me a longer note at whocentury@gmail.com. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Back soon with another episode. Thanks for listening.